Morning.
Good morning.
Please begin recording or whatever introduction we need here to start the tapes rolling. I'm Terry Fredheim, UC Duke Seminary in St. Paul, Minnesota, and working on the theme of God and creation, particularly in the Old Testament. And today, looked up the question, does God create the world alone? Or, in terms of an idiomatic expression, does God create the world all by himself? I want to answer that question, no, and try to explore particularly the opening chapters of Genesis that help us lift up this particular question and explore it more fully. In current discussions of the environment and creation considerations more generally, a couple of the in words are community, relationship. Whether or not you're dealing with these matters theologically or not, those are in words. All creatures together constitute a community in relationship. More particularly, human beings then are understood not as sort of isolated creatures of God, but as part of a global community which includes all creatures. Our lives touch the life of every creature, whether for good or for ill. Dennis Edwards, who is an Australian theologian, has a recent book entitled Ecology at the Heart of Faith, and he has this to say. Any contemporary theology of the human will need to situate the human within the community of life. It will need to be a theology of, and then these words are all hyphenated, need to be a theology of the human in relation to other creatures, unquote. Everything, everyone is in relationship. Reality is relational. That becomes the key to thinking about these matters. And as we have seen yesterday and will see again, such interrelatedness is true not only of the world and of its creatures, but it's also true of God. Both God and the world are who they are because they are in relationship with one another. Now there's one of the scholars who has worked so well in the area, in this particular area, is Douglas John Hall, a Canadian scholar, and he has got major volumes on systematic theology and so forth. He has an earlier book entitled Imaging of God, subtitled Dominion, the Dominion of Stewardship. And he has this statement about relationships, intercreaturely relationships. The confession that God is the source and ground of our being is simultaneously the confession of our dependence on all created others, not only parents and siblings, but the dogs and the cats whose presence in our childhood and at other times may have been even more significant than that of people. The animals and plants that sustain our bodies and the wine that makes our souls glad, the trees, the particular landscapes, the mountains, the sea, the rivers, the prairies, the sun and the sky, the ground with which, despite false pride, we have an aboriginal affinity. Through earth and all of these creatures, whoever they may be, our being has been shaped and is being sustained. I know perfectly well that I would not be who I have become or am becoming without the quite particular climate in which I was reared and lived most of my life, the snow. Or the animals I have loved and who have loved me more than I them. Or the trees, the splendid trees. So Douglas John Hall, we are who we are because of this complex and surroundings of which we are a part. And then Luther, in his commentary on Genesis, has this interesting tag along. The sun warms, But it would bring nothing into being unless God said by his divine power, let a mouse come out of the decay. Therefore, the mouse, too, is a divine creature. For its kind, it has a very beautiful form, such pretty feet, such delicate hair, that it's clear that it was created by the Word of God with a definite plan in view. Therefore, we should admire God's creation and workmanship. The same, he concludes, the same may be said about flies. Yeah. So Luther. At the same time, as we know, this community of which we are a part has been damaged, especially by the actions of human beings. Indeed, we could say that the church is a major culprit here, not least by its slowness in recognizing the need, its relatively tepid response, its silence, and all too often its theology. It is remarkably common among Christians that various theologies will not serve the larger creation very well. There's a theology of demolition, for example, that's firmly in place, where it's understood that the world is going to come to an end pretty soon anyway, so why bother to care about the environment? So we're faced then with a global crisis to which the church bears some responsibility, and which creatures of God's own making are threatened. Jürgen Moltmann, famous German theologian, whose major book on creation, God and Creation, says this: if human beings are themselves part of nature, then any destruction of nature necessarily also includes an element of human self-destruction. So any damage to the community or the communities to which we belong diminishes us all. We can be thankful, I think, for the increasing recognition of the issues that are at stake, the remarkable efforts that are being made within and without the church to preserve and enhance our interconnected life together. But there is much work to be done. And I propose then, in this, in drawing out some of our particular responsibilities in this area, to work primarily with the opening chapters of Genesis, especially the creation accounts, and to think through those accounts for some ways in which we can be guided in our reflections about these matters. Now, the use of Old Testament resources for such a task is relatively recent. Not least because through decades, creation has been a secondary theme with which scholars have been done. They've been primarily interested in redemption and those salvation themes, not creation themes. And so it's taken some effort to sort of get creation on board as one of the key concerns of these biblical materials. We must somehow gain a sense that creation is a primary theological vision in the Old Testament, and that how we think about the God of the Old Testament and the God more generally is going to sharply affect how we carry on this conversation. Now, the opening chapters of Genesis, we don't need to go into detail here with regard to background and so forth, but let me just give sort of a basic statement about the opening chapters of Genesis. What these chapters do is give us a universal frame of reference for everything that follows in the Bible. The bookends of the Bible, opening chapters of Genesis, the book of Revelation, the bookends of the Bible have to do with a universal frame of reference. You have to read through 11 chapters in the book of Genesis before you get to the people of God, Israel. You have to read 26 verses in the opening chapters of Genesis before you get to people. Universal frame of reference is a key to thinking about these particular matters. And then to repeat, if I may, just a couple of comments on the crucial character of our conversation relating to God. The word God in the phrase image of God, it's so often thought that God created the world with overwhelming power, in absolute control, working independently, working unilaterally. And if this understanding of God is correct, then those of us who are created in the image of this God properly can understand our role in comparable terms. That we will work with absolute power, in total control, independently, unilaterally. We will be like God, in whose image we are created. And that becomes then a significant task for us, is to think through who this God is, and what kind of God that these texts present to us. Now, and sort of another direction you can kind of take with this understanding of God is that if God is like this, in total control, taking care of everything, then we can relax. We can be have a passive relationship to the world around us, because God's going to take care of things. Just relax. And you don't have to worry at all about what might happen to the world. Just leave it up to God. I want to claim that while creatures are deeply dependent upon God for their creation and for their life, that God has chosen to establish an interdependent relationship with us, with respect to both originating creation, early chapters of Genesis, and with respect to continuing creation. And listen to Michael Welker, W-E-L-K-E-R, is a German theologian of some consequence, in an article about 15 years ago, really very helpful point made about the opening chapters of Genesis. In no way, he says, do the creation accounts of Genesis offer only a gloomy picture of sheer dependence. In no way. The creature's own activity is a constituting element in the process of creation and is seen to be in harmony with God's creative action. In my language, God's approach to creation is communal. It's relational. It's internal. God works from within and not sort of top down, if you will, from without. In the wake of God's initiating creative activity in Genesis, God creates from within using the creatures that God has already created. Now, there's several points here that I'd like to work through today and into tomorrow as a way of developing this angle of vision on these texts. One is, let me get this four of them. And we'll work with a couple of them here. God uses already existing creatures as material for creating still further creatures. Okay. That's one. Two, God calls upon, invites already existing creatures to participate in the creation of still further creatures. Third, God invites the divine assembly, we mentioned that briefly yesterday, to be a co-participant in certain acts of creation. And fourth, God invites the human being especially to be what I would call a created co-creator. And one of the things I would hope will come through here is that God works in and through that which is not God in developing the world, in bringing the world along. What human beings do, then, not only what human beings do, but what other creatures do, counts with respect to the development of the created order of things. Makes a difference to God and to the larger creation. Some ways in which we think about the opening chapters of Genesis is that the creation is a finished product. The sort of God wrapped it all up in a nice bag, put a red bow on it, and said, keep it exactly like I created it. That's the image, I think, that's commonly presented to us. And for the creation to stay just as God originally created it would be a failure of the divine design. From God's perspective, the world needs work at the end of the 7 days. The world needs work. Development and change are what God intends for the world. And God enlists creatures, both human and non-human creatures, in to pursue that particular end of development and change for the creation. Or from another angle, God did not exhaust the divine creativity at the end of the first week. God continues to create, God continues to use creatures in ongoing creative activity. Well, one of the interesting things about the opening chapters of Genesis is that we are given law there. Be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth, have dominion, subdue the earth. There it is. Before any sin at all, you get law. And law, then, we have a sense of law that convicts us of sin and drives us to Christ, kind of understanding law. But here, law pre-sin is an integral part of the world that God has created. And you could say that in these terms, God's creative involvement of the creature is made a matter of divine law from day one in the opening chapters of Genesis. Caring for the environment is integral from the beginning to what creatures are to be about. And so God creates a dynamic world in which the future is open to a number of possibilities, and creaturely activity then is crucial for proper creational developments. Now just to pause here for a moment and just speak more generally about biblical material, particularly Old Testament material. We need to remember again and again that God chooses to act in this world but never to act alone. God always works in and through agents. God always works in and through agents. And human beings, other creatures, and that way of God's working in the world is present from the very beginning in the creation account. Another thing to remember here, or generally, is God does not perfect creatures before deciding to work in and through them. Look around the room, maybe would be a way to... God always works with what's available. God works with what's available. Individuals, communities, institutions of society. More generally, we could say something like this. It gets us into another kind of conversation in some ways, but we'd have to say it seems to me that violence is characteristic, because violence is characteristic of the persons and institutions through which God's work gets done, that violence will be associated with God's work in the world, come what may. God does not micromanage the work of the creatures, exercises constraint and restraint and letting the agents be what they were created to be. Work by the agents will always have mixed results because of who the agents are. God's work, then, will be, in a sense, compromised in some fundamental way by the agents in and through which God works. And the results will be somewhat less than what would have happened had God chosen to act alone. So, and another thing too to remember, that God does not necessarily confer a positive value on the means in and through which God works. And so God will come back to critique the agents. And God's agents will often exceed the divine mandate, will not conform to the will of God in a given situation, will go beyond anything that God intended. And so, say, the Babylonians will wreak havoc in a way that God never intended, and yet God assumes a share of the responsibility associated with the work of the agents and takes part of the blame, God does, for using such agents. And so, for example, in Jeremiah 42, God will say in the wake of the Babylonian exceeding of the divine mandate, God will say, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Now, those just gathered comments about agency, for now moving to these four elements, we'll look at two of them today. First, God's use of already existing created matter in creating further creatures. We, just to begin with that opening verse 2 of Genesis 1, the earth was a formless void, darkness what covered the face of the deep, while a wind or a spirit or a breath, translation difficulty, of God swept over the face of the waters. That's a striking beginning. God moves, sweeps over the waters. And this image of wind, breath, suggests an ever-changing velocity, an ever-changing direction. What does it say in John 3? The wind blows where it will. If you do a word study of the moves, sweeps over the face of the waters, moves over the face of the waters, one of the, it's not used very often in the Old Testament, but one of the uses in Jeremiah 23 is for a drunken walk. That kind of movement, uncertain movement, over time, striking language that's used here. The Spirit, now in the opening verses of Genesis, works with already existing matter. Much of what is created in Genesis 1 already exists in verse 2. It's material out of which God creates still further creatures. Out of the mess of the chaos, verse 2 is just messy, formless, void, darkness, and so forth. Okay, out of the mess of the chaos, verse 2, the Spirit of God then uses this raw material of the most earthy sort, messy stuff indeed, brings it together, and creation is animated. So this language of winds sweeping over the water suggests that this kind of language for God's creative activity in terms of liveliness, movement, change, open-endedness, those are the kinds of words that one might use. It's an open process rather than one that's tightly controlled. What might it mean that the Bible begins with a vision of God where things are open-ended and not tightly controlled? Eugene Peterson, some of you may know about his work. He has a book, I've not seen much attention given to it, entitled Under the Unpredictable Plant. It's a study of the book of Jonah. And he has some comments here. They're sort of tucked into a chapter toward the end of the book. I think it's very striking, very helpful in terms of analyzing the open chapters of Genesis, though he himself does not apply this material in that way. But let me use it. He speaks of the mess of creativity. The mess of creativity. He says, I can never be involved in creativity except by entering the mess. Mess is the precondition of creativity. He adds that in every creative enterprise, there are risks that are essential to the meaning of creativity. False starts, failures, frustrations, embarrassments, even for God. But out of a mess, there slowly emerges love, beauty, and peace. So Peterson, creative activity is itself finally unmanageable. Look at children. And when the spirit is at work, you can't apply time management techniques. You can't hire efficiency experts. To be a creator entails an almost infinite tolerance of mess, of inefficiency. And the moment, isn't it true, the moment that tidiness or strict orderliness becomes the rule of the day, isn't creativity inhibited? And the appearance of the genuinely new seems to slow way down. There's an open-endedness in these opening chapters of Genesis to which the work of the Spirit testifies. For some disorder to continue beyond God's initial creative activity in Genesis 1 and 2 is necessary, it seems, for the proper development of creation. Listen to Sibley Towner. He's got a nice little commentary on Genesis in the Westminster series. He talks about this opening chapter of Genesis. If there were no freedom in the creation, no touches of disorder, no open ends, then moral choice, creativity, and excellence could not arise. The world would be a monotonous cycle of inevitability, a dull as dishwater world of puppets and automatons. The mess of creativity is necessary rather than a meticulous blueprint. God as a, I mean, this Mr. God doesn't paint by numbers. God gives to creation the continuing capacity not only to be itself, to be what it was created to be, but to develop into something more. So the Spirit working in and through existing matter and other creatures enables genuine novelty to continue to emerge. When I was working on some of this material, an article appeared in the New York Times entitled Saying Yes to Mess. My wife doesn't like this article. You can Google it. It's December 21, 2006. 2 years ago. December 21, 2006. And these are just a few phrases from that article. It's a flippant remark, but if you've never had a messy kitchen, you've probably never had a home-cooked meal. Mess is robust and adaptable as opposed to brittle. Mess is complete in that it embraces all sorts of random elements. Mess tells a story. You can learn a lot about people from the messes they make. Whereas neat, well, neat is a closed book. Neat has no narrative. My wife disagrees with that. Mess is also a real, is also a natural and a real time saver. It takes. It takes extra effort to neaten up a system. Things generally don't neaten themselves. And then this quote, the quote from Einstein. If a cluttered desk is a sign of a cluttered mind, what then of an empty desk? I got that written above my desk. This theme of God creating in and through existing messy stuff continues in Genesis 2. You've got it at the very beginning of the Bible, in Genesis 1. It continues in Genesis 2, where God apparently assumes human form. In Genesis 3, you get God walking in the garden in the cool of the day. Well, back in Genesis 2, you get God getting down in the dirt and forming a human being out of the dirt of the ground. It's a wonderful image of God, of sort of, can you just get an image of God down there in the dirt? molding as human being, getting dirt under the divine fingernails, if you will. This ground, this dirt, and the word for ground and the word for the man are intimately related, Adam and Adama. The ground proves to be a crucial ingredient for the creation of the human. Human beings are not created out of nothing, no way in the text, but out of an already existing non-human creature that has its own creative capacities, namely the ground. And God is imaged here as a potter who molds a human being and then animals later out of the dust of the earth. Breathes into these creatures the breath of life. And God breathes not only into human beings, but into the animals too. Sometimes Genesis 2, how does the old King James Version put it? God breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living soul, and all kinds of soul theology and everything emerging out of that. But the same language is used for the animals in Genesis 7. Here God is imaged as a surgeon, you might say, perhaps even an anesthesiologist, the way he puts Adam to sleep, removes a part of his body, and a number of scholars are saying now it's not a rib, but it's a full side of a man that's taken, and out of which the woman is created. I mean, messy! I mean, can you just imagine the mess? Blood all over the place, out of which God creates the woman, and so what time it is, commonly is when you are creating, it gets messy. Some people have thought over the years that because the woman was created out of the man, it must mean that the woman is subordinate to the man. If you take that move, then, let's see, because the man was created out of the dirt, then the man must be subordinate to the dirt, right? That sort of argument doesn't work. God, in creating this way, then, comes into contact with that which is material, that which is earthy, that which is messy. And this common notion that's out and about, I don't know where, you wonder where it comes from, that the guy is external from the creation. We're standing out there and speaking the word and poof, you know, there it comes into being. That's not what the texts are working with here. God creates from within the world, gets down into the world itself to create. And God brings into being creatures with the help of already existing creatures. God, of course, could simply have spoken a word, poof, and it would have been done. But God didn't choose to do it that way, normally at least. God has chosen then, I mean, God doesn't need the world to be God. But apparently, God here needs the world in order to continue to create the world in the way that God has chosen to do so. Testimony of Genesis 1 to the goodness of all created things is undergirded then in Genesis 2 with respect to this tangible, tactile engagement of God with the already existing creatures out of which new creatures emerge. So God touches the earth without compromising God's godness in any way. God takes on the stuff of creation. And the psalmist will put his hands formed the dry land, or Psalm 8, his fingers created the heavens and the earth. If God, in fact, assumes human form to bring these creatures into being in the open chapters of Genesis, that means that already existing creatures bear God bodily into the world. God takes on human form, wears the very creatures in creating further creatures. And already here, could we say this as Christians? Already here, God is prone to incarnation. Already here. And God breathes the breath of life into these creatures. Now, what are the environmental implications of this point that God's, I think that there's a basic point here, that God deeply values the stuff of creation, the stuff of earthly life, and if this earthly stuff is of such value to God, certainly it should be of value to human beings. Indeed, if we might think of the dirt as part of our genealogy, and not unrelated to the statement in Genesis 2:4a that so these are the generations of the heavens and the earth when they were created. This is genealogical material, so that part of our ancestry has to do with the non-human creatures. How are you going to treat your ancestors? If the God of the creation is one who takes on human form too in the creative process, takes on the very stuff of the creation, then that's an implicit invitation, at least, that we are to engage in creativity in similar ways. Now then, take the second one. So God creates out of our existing creatures. A second one to look at briefly here is God calls upon already existing creatures to bring about new creations. Already in Genesis 1, early as verse 11, listen to what it says. God invites, let the earth bring forth. Let the earth bring forth. And we are told, the earth brought forth. The earth is the subject of the creating verbs, not God. The earth brought forth. And then on days 5 and 6, God invites the water and the earth to bring forth further creatures. In these cases, in 5 and 6, God becomes the subject of the creating verbs that follow. But given the pattern established in verses 11 to 13, where the earth brought forth, this suggests that the waters and the earth are co-participants with God in bringing further creations into being. God speaks here with already existing creatures and involves them in creative activity. Now, this is mediated creation. It's not immediate. This is a communicating word. It's not a top-down word. It's not a unilateral act. It's a multilateral act. God's creating is not done alone. God gets help from the creatures who are already existing. So that the non-human creature, and these texts will get later, more tomorrow in terms of human creature, but the non-human creature here has a genuine vocational role to play. Think of that phrase, come back to it. The non-human has a vocational role to play with respect to the continuing creation of the world. That certainly has been the case, hasn't it been the case? Over and over again through the centuries that the non-human creatures have been agents of God's creative activity. Ever new creatures have come into being through the activity of such creatures. Think, for example, of glaciers, or volcanoes, or tsunamis, earthquakes. God's continuing creation of the world makes use of these agents in bringing ever new creatures into being. Did God create these mountains which were surrounded? Well, yes and no. God's involved, but certainly God uses creatures, already existing creatures, to create such wonderful phenomena. So, John Polkinghorne is one of the fine scientist theologians that's at work these days. He was just on NPR here a month or so ago, working, what's the name of that program?
Speaking of Faith.
Speaking of Faith, thank you. Yeah, talking with Krista Tippett about these matters. And let me just pick up on a couple of sentences that he uses. God, no doubt, could have snapped the divine fingers and brought into being a ready-made world. But God has done something cleverer than that. God has made a world in which creatures could make themselves. But that it has a necessary cost. It has a shadow side. It gets messy. And we could add even violent. Now, what are the environmental implications of this fact that God calls upon already existing non-human creatures to bring about still other creatures, entirely new creatures for that matter? Once again, I think, the text demonstrates the immense value of non-human creatures for God. And that God so invites them and involves them in the creation of ever new creatures. Without the help of the non-human creature in these texts, God's creation would not live up to its potential of becoming. So, that's a call, it seems to me, to value the non-human creatures in such a way, not least because of their potential for bringing into being still further creations. Now these texts, a couple more words here and let's open it up. These texts are at the same time in sort of letting the world create itself, if you will, a witness to divine self-limitation. God pulls back, limits the divine power, and opens up space for the creatures to do what they do. And God limits the divine freedom. God is committed to the structures of creation that they, as created, will continue to, God, without divine interference, God enables the creatures to be and to become what they were created to be. And what we'll look at briefly tomorrow, in terms of the text, one of the ways in which the text wants to say this is, what does God do on the seventh day? God rests. God pulls back. Doesn't do it. But lets the creatures be what they were created to be without managing them in some precise or meticulous way. Now, for the earth and the waters and for other creatures to participate in this kind of creative activity means, again, as I suggested, that things are going to be disordered. Creation is going to be messy. And that will entail, often, I think, much suffering in its wake. And as we'll see on Thursday, God created the world good, not perfect. And one of the elements of that is that because water and earth and so forth are not machines that work in precise and mechanistic ways, that this will mean that suffering is an integral part of the created order of things before sin ever enters the picture. And we'll need to talk further about that on Thursday. So maybe that's enough for me. Questions, comments you might have? materials and just one. Yes, please.
Now, this understanding that you presented, I sense, is quite different from what would have been the prevailing theology of creation 100 years ago, or even 50 years ago, perhaps, within the Lutheran Church. Is that not true? And is it a trend, or is...
You're quite right. This is not a prevailing understanding of creation 100 years ago, 50 years ago, a generation ago, even. We're moving in our assessment of this material. My citation of John Polkinghorne here, one of the reasons, I think, for this development is the increasing conversation between the scientist and the theologian. And it's one of the pieces I'll cite on Thursday is from a scientist at Calvin College in Michigan, and where he lifts up the messiness and the complexity of the creation process. And that, but one of the things that conversation does is it gives you some new lenses with which to look at the text. And let's look at the text from that angle. What might be there where some connections could be made between more contemporary ways of thinking about the creative process and the biblical way of portraying it. And what I'm trying to do here then is make some of those connections. And the messiness seems to me to be really, scientists tell me that's an important word to use with regard to the creative process. And I think that the texts themselves have that kind of characteristic. There are two back there, side by side. You decide which one wants to go first.
You talked at the very beginning, you talked about, you know, within the relationality of God within God's own self. And I was wondering if you could come back to that in terms of especially the creation story. I mean, that, you know, later on I heard you talking more about God as sort of, you know, God could limit God's self, or God, it seems sort of almost that, more sort of a mono view. I mean, God, creator, God, them. And, you know, what evidence do you find within the first, you know, two chapters of Genesis that sort of give glimmers of this, our understanding of the triunity of God, and of the triune God, and how, you know, that God in God's own self is in relationship?
Yeah. That's a... That will be a theme that will pop up now and again the balance of the week. Let me say a few things here. I think that it's generally agreed now, unlike 1900 years plus of Christian history, that the Old Testament doesn't get the Trinity. The Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, Trinitarian interrelationship is just not an Old Testament theme. In fact, if you take a close look at the New Testament barely gets there, okay? And but one of the things that, a Christian with a Trinitarian perspective, looking back into those texts and observing some of the dynamics of the sort of God's activity, talk about the Spirit of God, so forth, discerns that God is a part of a community. There's this sort of, I think, the language, the sociality of God, is recognized in these texts in a whole variety of ways, and so that's not Trinity talk, I think. No, I don't think we need to go there. But what we've got is we've got a theological matrix, a theological understandings of God that enable later Trinitarian understandings to emerge. Who is it? Patrick Miller, I think, Old Testament scholar, says at one point, without the Old Testament, we wouldn't have Trinity. We wouldn't have been able to get there. So if we can think in more theological developmental terms, and there's an honoring here, or a lifting up of the Old Testament as containing real insight into the relationality of God here, that enables such further development. So there's an honoring. As an Old Testament scholar, I want to keep my job and learn some more.
I'm
going to
personalize that.
But your partner back there.
I I guess the simple version of the question is, what do you make of the text? It is good in this sort of a presentation.
Yeah. That's my topic for Thursday.
I hope you figure
it out. Let me just say one little bit more complicated. It seems to me Jewish, in general, Jewish understanding would be less, in general, Jewish understanding is less troubled by your presentation than a lot of Christian understanding of what good means in the text. The Jews seem to understand the messiness of it more than we like to.
That's an interesting comment. Never heard it put quite like that, but it's worth examining more closely. Somebody, a Jewish scholar, Orthodox Jewish scholar, like John Levinson, for example, who teaches at Harvard, I think would be very comfortable with what you've just said. Whether I think the Christian perspective on here is so diverse.
Sure.
You know, you do have folks who have been moving along these lines of thoughts for some time, but it's beginning now to emerge and to sort of, you might say, crowd out older understandings of creation in ways that we've got to wake up to this. Not least because of the connections that this sort of understanding of the Genesis text and scientific understandings are developing. It's important. Yes, this.
A couple things. First, I've been married for 42 years. Your discussion about kitchens and desktops didn't do me any good at all. College physics that matter can't be created or destroyed.
Can't say that way.
Matter can't be created or destroyed. You can't destroy matter. You can take ice and turn it into water. You can take water and turn it into steam. Even with nuclear fission, you don't really get rid of anything, and you don't create anything new. What we're doing is, it seems to me, I'm still not sold on the idea that this wasn't created as a one-shot thing. And what we're really doing is manipulating what we've got. I mean, plastic, the internet, all this stuff has always existed in creation.
No, I would say no.
Really?
I would say, certainly there are elements.
The tools we have in medicine, most of them come from, a lot of them come from
sure.
nature, have always been here.
Well, have they always been there in
this
form?
Right.
Is there something, are there not, even though you're making use of already existing creatures, if you will, putting them together enable something genuinely new to emerge?
But you're not creating matter the way God created matter.
Well, it depends upon what you mean by God. All you need for a creation out of nothing is a Big Bang theory or something like that. Immediately in these texts, you get God working with already existing creatures and bringing forth new creatures. So human beings, is that a new creature?
I'm not sure about this, I'm just asking.
Yeah. human beings are made out of the stuff that's already there. And so there's a sense in which you can say, well, that's nothing new. But yes, I think depends a little bit, I think, on what you mean by newness or genuine newness. One of the places to begin would be with human beings created out of already existing stuff. Yes, please.
So Dolly, it was all right to create Dolly.
Yeah. Okay.
The sheep.
You're talking about the cloning of the sheep?
Right.
Yeah. Well, I think there are ethical issues that arise here with regard to the use of already existing creatures. Not just anything that you want to do with existing creatures immediately is evaluated as good. We can misuse the stuff of the world, and ways that are the result of which is not good. And so there's going to have to be careful ethical considerations with regard to these kinds of matters, and not just an immediate, but some kind of immediate recognition that whatever we do is good. No. Yes.
There was a hand up there.
Yes. Okay. Peter. Yeah.
I've heard the term "we are co-creators with God" used frequently, and you got close to that but didn't use it. What do you think of that?
Yeah. Sure.
Is there some admonition there to watch out about becoming too godlike?
Yeah. We're gonna. The fourth item that I had in my list has to do with the use of human beings as what I call created co-creators, rather than simply a co-creator. Now that's a language I borrowed from Phil Hefner as part of LSDC, I think it's helpful to put the word created before the word co-creator to make sure that we don't understand ourselves to be at the same level with God or God-like in some fundamental sense. So yes, I think that one of the things when people have come after me a little bit in the discipline for using this language, because you're using language that ought to be reserved for God. And the more in which I work with these tags, the more I see how God catches up already existing creatures in the creative process. So creativity is the language that we ought to use for the human, and not just for God. The language best used to express that, we can struggle with. But let's not somehow back away from the idea that somehow that humans can be genuinely creative. Yes. Oh, I'm much sorry over here. I've been looking in a different direction. Please. Yeah.
Does the current scholarship in the language of the Old Testament text support this emerging view of co-creation?
Well, I have begun to publish this material. I'm reading a paper along these lines at the Society of Biblical Literature meeting in Boston in November. We'll see how scholars react with the material. The initial reaction is good. Some are troubled a little bit, but we're on the way towards some interesting conversations. And if nothing else, what will emerge on the far side of this conversation, a generation down the pike, that's what we're looking at, I think, will be a different understanding of creation, even though it may not exactly look like this. Simply because there are new questions in the room, there are new ways of looking at text, and that's going to help us further our reflections about what the matter. In the back, yes, please.
This phrase, created in the image of God, has always seemed to me be very ambiguous. I've never understood what it means, and I think a lot of people think they understand what it means, and I think it leads to a lot of misuse of that phrase, a lot of arrogance for humans.
Say, what sort of misuse, what understandings are you applying that word to?
Well, for example, our relationship to the animal and plant kingdom that you were talking about. It just seems, what does image of God mean?
I think that's will be a continuing concern for us, but let me lift up just one consideration there. I think that scholars, the church, have not been helpful here.
I agree.
Okay. There have been helpful things said over the years, but that's been pushed in a direction, I think, that if we're in the image of God, and then we have a certain image of God, that we're to follow, and sort of manipulate, exploit, deal with whatever we want to do, etc. That kind of understanding of image is arrogant. I agree with you. And we need to work carefully on this topic. If you take a look at scholarship, as I think I mentioned yesterday, scholarship has been devoted to spinning out what image might mean or likeness might mean, and they have not attended very well to what God means in these texts. An image and God come together in that phrase, and both words must receive careful attention. Thank you very much for today.